What if it were possible to reopen critical period plasticity so that adults could pick up languages the way children do just by being exposed to them? Mrzenik had already shown that plasticity extends into adulthood, and that with work, by paying close attention, we can rewire our brains. But now he was asking, could the critical period of effortless learning be extended? Learning in the critical period is effortless because during that period the nucleus basalis is always on. So Mrzenik and his young colleague Michael Kilgard set up an experiment in which they artificially turned on the nucleus basalis in adult rats and gave them learning tasks where they wouldn't have to pay attention and wouldn't receive a reward for learning. They inserted microelectrodes into the nucleus basalis and used an electric current to keep it turned on. Then they exposed the rats to a 9 Hz sound frequency to see if they could effortlessly develop a brain map location for it, the way pups do during the critical period. After a week, Kilgard and Mrzenik found they could massively expand the brain map for that particular sound frequency. They had found an artificial way to reopen the critical period in adults. They then used the same technique to get the brain to speed up its processing time. Normally, an adult rat's auditory neurons can only respond to tones at a maximum of 12 pulses per second. By stimulating the nucleus basalis, it was possible to educate the neurons to respond to ever more rapid inputs. This work opens up the possibility of high-speed learning later in life. The nucleus basalis could be turned on by an electrode, by micro-injections of certain chemicals, or by drugs. It is hard to imagine that people will not, for better or for worse, be drawn to a technology that would make it relatively effortless to master the facts of science, history, or a profession merely by being exposed to them briefly. Imagine immigrants coming to a new country, now able to pick up their new language with ease and without an accent in a matter of months. Imagine how the lives of older people who have been laid off from a job might be transformed if they were able to learn a new skill with the alacrity they had in early childhood. Such techniques would no doubt be used by high school and university students in their studies and in competitive entrance exams. Already, many students who do not have attention deficit disorder use stimulants to study. Of course, such aggressive interventions might have unanticipated adverse effects on the brain, not to mention our ability to discipline ourselves. But they would likely be pioneered in cases of dire medical need, where people are willing to take the risk. Turning on the nucleus basalis might help brain-injured patients, so many of whom cannot relearn the lost functions of reading, writing, speaking, or walking because they can't pay close enough attention. Mrzenik has started a new company, Posit Science, devoted to helping people preserve the plasticity of their brains as they age and extend their mental lifespans. He's 61, but is not reluctant about calling himself old. I love old people. I've always loved old people. Probably my favorite person was my paternal grandfather, one of the 3 or 4 most intelligent and interesting people I've met in life. Grandpa Mrzenik came from Germany at 9 on one of the last clipper ships. He was self-educated, an architect, and a building contractor. He lived to be 79 at a time when life expectancy was closer to 40. It's estimated that by the time someone who is 65 now dies, the life expectancy will be in the late 80s. Well, when you are 85, there is a 47% chance that you will have Alzheimer's disease. He laughs. So we've created this bizarre situation in which we are keeping people alive long enough so that on the average, half of them get the black rock before they die. We've got to do something about the mental lifespan, to extend it out and into the body's lifespan. Mrzenik thinks our neglect of intensive learning as we age leads the systems in the brain that modulate, regulate, and control plasticity to waste away. In response, he has developed brain exercises for age-related cognitive decline, the common decline of memory, thinking, and processing speed. Mrzenik's way of attacking mental decline is at odds with mainstream neuroscience. Tens of thousands of papers written about the physical and chemical changes that occur in the aging brain describe processes that occur as neurons die. There are many drugs on the market and scores of drugs in the pipeline designed to block these processes and raise levels of falling chemicals in the brain. Yet Merzenich believes that such drugs, worth billions in sales, provide only about 4 to 6 months of improvement. "And there is something really wrong about all this," he says. "It all neglects the role of what is required to sustain normal skills and abilities. It is as if your skills and abilities acquired in the brain at some young age are just destined to deteriorate as the physical brain deteriorates." The mainstream approach, he argues, is based on no real understanding of what it takes to develop a new skill in the brain, never mind to sustain it. "It is imagined," he says, "that if you manipulate the levels of the right neurotransmitter, that memory will be recovered and cognition will be useful, and you will start moving like a gazelle again." The mainstream approach doesn't take into account what is required to maintain a sharp memory. A major reason memory loss occurs as we age is that we have trouble registering new events in our nervous systems because processing speed slows down, so that the accuracy, strength, and sharpness with which we perceive declines. If you can't register something clearly, you won't be able to remember it well. Take one of the most common problems of aging, trouble finding words. Merzenich thinks this problem often occurs because of the gradual neglect and atrophy of the brain's attentional system and nucleus basalis, which have to be engaged for plastic change to occur. This atrophy leads to our representing oral speech with fuzzy engrams, meaning that the representation of sounds or words is not sharp because the neurons that encode these fuzzy engrams are not firing in the coordinated quick way needed to send a powerful sharp signal. Because the neurons that represent speech pass on fuzzy signals to all neurons downstream from them, muddy in, muddy out, we also have trouble remembering, finding, and using words. It is similar to the problem we saw occurring in the brains of language-impaired children, who also have noisy brains. When our brains are noisy, the signal for a new memory can't compete against the background electrical activity of the brain, causing a signal noise problem. Merzenich says the system gets noisier for two reasons. First, because as everyone knows, everything is progressively going to hell. But the main reason it is getting noisier is that it is not being appropriately exercised. The nucleus basalis, which works by secreting acetylcholine, which, as we said, helps the brain tune in and form sharp memories, has been totally neglected. In a person with mild cognitive impairment, the acetylcholine produced in the nucleus basalis is not even measurable. We have an intense period of learning in childhood. Every day is a day of new stuff, and then, in our early employment, we are intensely engaged in learning and acquiring new skills and abilities. And more as we progress in life, we are operating as users of mastered skills and abilities. Psychologically, middle age is often an appealing time because, all else being equal, it can be a relatively placid period compared with what has come before. Our bodies aren't changing as they did in adolescence. We're more likely to have a solid sense of who we are and be skilled at a career. We still regard ourselves as active, but we have a tendency to deceive ourselves into thinking that we are learning as we were before. We rarely engage in tasks in which we must focus our attention as closely as we did when we were younger, trying to learn a new vocabulary or master new skills. Such activities as reading the newspaper, practicing a profession of many years, and speaking our own language are mostly the replay of mastered skills, not learning. By the time we hit our 70s, we may not have systematically engaged the systems in the brain that regulate plasticity for 50 years. That's why learning a new language in old age is so good for improving and maintaining the memory generally, because it requires intense focus. Studying a new language turns on the control system for plasticity and keeps it in good shape for laying down sharp memories of all kinds. No doubt, fast forward is responsible for so many general improvements in thinking, in part because it stimulates the control system for plasticity to keep up its production of acetylcholine and dopamine. Anything that requires highly focused attention will help that system. Learning new physical activities that require concentration, solving challenging puzzles, or making a career change that requires that you master new skills and material. Mrzenik himself is an advocate of learning a new language in old age. You will gradually sharpen everything up again, and that will be very highly beneficial to you. The same applies to mobility. Just doing the dances you learned years ago won't help your brain's motor cortex stay in shape. To keep the mind alive requires learning something truly new with intense focus. That is what will allow you to both lay down new memories and have a system that can easily access and preserve the older ones. The 36 scientists at Posit Science are working on 5 areas that tend to fall apart as we age. The key in developing exercises is to give the brain the right stimuli, in the right order, with the right timing to drive plastic change. Part of the scientific challenge is to find the most efficient way to train the brain by finding mental functions to train that apply to real life. Mrzenik told me, "Everything that you can see happen in a young brain can happen in an older brain. The only requirement is that the person must have enough of a reward or punishment to keep paying attention through what might otherwise be a boring training session. If so," he says, "the changes can be every bit as great as the changes in a newborn." Posit Science has exercises for memory of words and language using fast forward, like listening exercises and computer games for auditory memory designed for adults. Instead of giving people with fading memories lists of words to memorize, as many self-help books recommend, these exercises rebuild the brain's basic ability to process sound by getting people to listen to slowed, refined speech sounds. Mrzenik doesn't believe you can improve a fading memory by asking people to do what they can't. "We don't want to kick a dead horse with training," he says. Adults do exercises that refine their ability to hear in a way they haven't since they were in the crib trying to separate out mother's voice from background noise. The exercises increase processing speed and make basic signals stronger, sharper, and more accurate, while stimulating the brain to produce the dopamine and acetylcholine. Various universities are now testing the memory exercises using standardized tests of memory, and Posit Science has published its first control study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, USA. Adults between the ages of 60 and 87 trained on the auditory memory program an hour a day, 5 days a week, for 8 to 10 weeks, a total of 40 to 50 hours of exercises. Before the training, the subjects functioned on average like typical 70-year-olds on standard memory tests. After, they functioned like people in the broad 40 to 60-year-old range. Thus, many turned back their memory clock 10 or more years, and some individuals turned it back about 25 years. These improvements held at a 3-month follow-up. A group at the University of California at Berkeley, led by William Jagast, did before and after PET, positron emission tomography scans, of people who underwent the training and found that their brains did not show the signs of metabolic decline, neurons gradually becoming less active, typically seen in people of their age. The study also compared 71-year-old subjects who used the auditory memory program with those of the same age who spent the same amount of time reading newspapers, listening to audiobooks, or playing computer games. Those who didn't use the program showed signs of continuing metabolic decline in their frontal lobes, while those who used it didn't. Rather, program users showed increased metabolic activity in their right parietal lobes and in a number of other brain areas, which correlated with their better performance on memory and attention tests. These studies show that brain exercises not only slow age-related cognitive decline, but can lead to improved functioning. And keep in mind that these changes were seen with only 40 to 50 hours of brain exercise. It may be that with more work, greater change is possible. Mrzenik says that they have been able to turn back the clock on people's cognitive functioning so that their memories, problem-solving abilities, and language skills are more youthful again. "We've driven people to abilities that apply to a much more youthful person, 20 or 30 years of reversal. An 80-year-old is acting, operationally, like they are 50 or 60 years old." These exercises are now available in 30 independent living communities and for individuals through the Posit Science website. Posit Science is also working on visual processing. As we age, we stop seeing clearly, not just because our eyes fail, but because the vision processors in the brain weaken. The elderly are more easily distracted and more prone to lose control of their visual attention. Posit Science is developing computer exercises to keep people on task and speed up visual processing by asking subjects to search for various objects on a computer screen. There are exercises for the frontal lobes that support our executive function, such as focusing on goals, extracting themes from what we perceive, and making decisions. These exercises are also designed to help people categorize things, follow complex instructions, and strengthen associative memory, which helps put people, places, and things into context. Posit Science is also working on fine motor control. As we age, many of us give up on tasks such as drawing, knitting, playing musical instruments, or woodworking because we can't control the fine movements in our hands. These exercises, now being developed, will make fading hand maps in the brain more precise. Finally, they are working on gross motor control, a function that declines as we age, leading to loss of balance, the tendency to fall, and difficulties with mobility. Aside from the failure of vestibular processing, this decline is caused by the decrease in sensory feedback from our feet. According to Merzenich, shoes worn for decades limit the sensory feedback from our feet to our brain. If we went barefoot, our brains would receive many different kinds of input as we went over uneven surfaces. Shoes are a relatively flat platform that spreads out the stimuli, and the surfaces we walk on are increasingly artificial and perfectly flat. This leads us to de-differentiate the maps for the soles of our feet and limit how touch guides our foot control. Then we may start to use canes, walkers, or crutches, or rely on other senses to steady ourselves. By resorting to these compensations instead of exercising our failing brain systems, we hasten their decline. As we age, we want to look down at our feet while walking downstairs or on slightly challenging terrain, because we're not getting much information from our feet. As Merzenich escorted his mother-in-law down the stairs of the villa, he urged her to stop looking down and start feeling her way, so that she would maintain and develop the sensory map for her foot, rather than letting it waste away. Having devoted years to enlarging brain maps, Merzenich now believes there are times you want to shrink them. He has been working on developing a mental eraser that can eliminate a problematic brain map. This technique could be of great use for people who have post-traumatic flashbacks, recurring obsessional thoughts, phobias, or problematic mental associations. Of course, its potential for abuse is chilling. Merzenich continues to challenge the view that we are stuck with the brain we have at birth. The Merzenich brain is structured by its constant collaboration with the world, and it is not only the parts of the brain most exposed to the world, such as our senses, that are shaped by experience. Plastic change caused by our experience travels deep into the brain and ultimately even into our genes, molding them as well, a topic to which we shall return. This Mediterranean-style villa where he spends so much time sits among low mountains. He has just planted his own vineyard, and we walk through it. At night, we talk about his early years studying philosophy, while four generations of his spirited family tease each other, breaking into peals of laughter. On the couch sits Merzenich's latest grandchild, just a few months old and in the midst of many critical periods. She makes everyone around her happy because she is such a good audience. You can coo at her, and she listens, thrilled. You tickle her toes, and she is completely attentive. As she looks around the room, she takes in everything. Chapter 4. Acquiring Tastes and Loves. What Neuroplasticity Teaches Us About Sexual Attraction and Love. A was a single, handsome young man who came to me because he was depressed. He had just gotten involved with a beautiful woman who had a boyfriend, and she had begun to encourage him to abuse her. She tried to draw A into acting out sexual fantasies in which she dressed up as a prostitute, and he was to take charge of her and become violent in some way. When A began to feel an alarming wish to oblige her, he got very upset, broke it off, and sought treatment. He had a history of involvement with women who were already attached to other men and emotionally out of control. His girlfriends had either been demanding and possessive or castratingly cruel. Yet these were women who thrilled him. Nice girls, thoughtful, kind women, bored him, and he felt that any woman who fell in love with him in a tender, uncomplicated way was defective. His own mother was a severe alcoholic, frequently needy, seductive, and given to emotional storms and violent rages throughout his childhood. A recalled her banging his sister's head against the radiator and burning his stepbrother's fingers as a punishment for playing with matches. She was frequently depressed, often threatening suicide, and his role was to be on the alert, calm her, and prevent her. His relationship with her was also highly sexualized. She wore see-through nighties and talked to him as though he were a lover. He thought he recalled her inviting him into her bed when he was a child, and had an image of himself sitting with his foot in her vagina while she masturbated. He had an exciting but furtive feeling about the scene. On the rare occasions when his father, who had retreated from his wife, was home, A recalled himself as perpetually short of breath and trying to stop fights between his parents, who eventually divorced. A spent much of his childhood stifling his rage at both parents and often felt like a volcano about to burst. Intimate relationships seemed like forms of violence in which others threatened to eat him alive, and yet by the time he had passed through childhood, it was for women who promised to do just that and them alone that he had acquired an erotic taste. Human beings exhibit an extraordinary degree of sexual plasticity compared with other creatures. We vary in what we like to do with our partners in a sexual act. We vary where in our bodies we experience sexual excitement and satisfaction. But most of all, we vary in whom or what we are attracted to. People often say they find a particular type attractive or a turn-on, and these types vary immensely from person to person. For some, the types change as they go through different periods and have new experiences. One homosexual man had successive relations with men from one race or ethnic group, then with those from another, and in each period he could be attracted only to men in the group that was currently hot. After one period was over, he could never be attracted to a man from the old group again. He acquired a taste for these types in quick succession, and seemed more smitten by the person's category or type, that is, Asians or African Americans, than by the individual. The plasticity of this man's sexual taste exaggerates a general truth, that the human libido is not a hardwired, invariable biological urge, but can be curiously fickle, easily altered by our psychology and the history of our sexual encounters. And our libido can also be finicky. Much scientific writing implies otherwise and depicts the sexual instinct as a biological imperative, an ever-hungry brute, always demanding satisfaction, a glutton, not a gourmet. But human beings are more like gourmets and are drawn to types and have strong preferences. Having a type causes us to defer satisfaction until we find what we are looking for, because attraction to a type is restrictive. The person who is really turned on by blondes may tacitly rule out brunettes and redheads. Even sexual preference can occasionally change. Though some scientists increasingly emphasize the inborn basis of our sexual preferences, it is also true that some people have heterosexual attractions for part of their lives, with no history of bisexuality, and then add on a homosexual attraction and vice versa. Sexual plasticity may seem to have reached its height in those who have had many different partners, learning to adapt to each new lover. But think of the plasticity required of the aging married couple with a good sex life. They look very different in their 20s, when they met, than they do in their 60s, yet their libidos adjust, so they remain attracted. But sexual plasticity goes further still. Fetishists desire inanimate objects. The male fetishist can be more excited by a high-heeled shoe with a fur trim or by a woman's lingerie than by a real woman. Since ancient times, some human beings in rural areas have had intercourse with animals. Some people seem to be attracted not so much to people as to complex sexual scripts, where partners play roles, involving various perversions combining sadism, masochism, voyeurism, and exhibitionism. When they place an ad in the personals, the description of what they are looking for in a lover often sounds more like a job description than like that of a person they would like to know. Given that sexuality is an instinct, and instinct is traditionally defined as a hereditary behavior unique to a species, varying little from one member to the next, the variety of our sexual tastes is curious. Instincts generally resist change and are thought to have a clear, non-negotiable, hardwired purpose, such as survival. Yet the human sexual instinct seems to have broken free of its core purpose, reproduction, and varies to a bewildering extent, as it does not in other animals in which the sexual instinct seems to behave itself and act like an instinct. No other instinct can so satisfy without accomplishing its biological purpose, and no other instinct is so disconnected from its purpose. Anthropologists have shown that for a long time humanity did not know that sexual intercourse was required for reproduction. This fact of life had to be learned by our ancestors, just as children must learn it today. This detachment from its primary purpose is perhaps the ultimate sign of sexual plasticity. Love, too, is remarkably flexible, and its expression has changed through history. Though we speak of romantic love as the most natural of sentiments, in fact, the concentration of our adult hopes for intimacy, tenderness, and lust in one person until death do us part is not common to all societies, and has only recently become widespread in our own. For a millennia, most marriages were arranged by parents for practical reasons. Certainly, there are unforgettable stories of romantic love linked to marriage in the Bible, as in the Song of Songs, and linked to disaster in medieval troubadour poetry and later in Shakespeare. But romantic love began to gain social approval in the aristocracies and courts of Europe only in the 12th century. Originally between an unmarried man and a married woman, either adulterous or unconsummated, usually ending badly. Only with the spread of democratic ideals of individualism did the idea that lovers ought to be able to choose spouses for themselves take firmer hold and gradually begin to seem completely natural and inalienable. It is reasonable to ask whether our sexual plasticity is related to neuroplasticity. Research has shown that neuroplasticity is neither ghettoized within certain departments in the brain nor confined to the sensory, motor, and cognitive processing areas we have already explored. The brain structure that regulates instinctive behaviors, including sex, called the hypothalamus, is plastic, as is the amygdala, the structure that processes emotion and anxiety. While some parts of the brain, such as the cortex, may have more plastic potential because there are more neurons and connections to be altered, even non-cortical areas display plasticity. It is a property of all brain tissue. Plasticity exists in the hippocampus, the area that turns our memories from short-term to long-term ones, as well as in areas that control our breathing, process primitive sensation, and process pain. It exists in the spinal cord, as scientists have shown. Actor Christopher Reeve, who suffered a severe spinal injury, demonstrated such plasticity when he was able, through relentless exercise, to recover some feeling and mobility 7 years after his accident. Mrzenik puts it this way, "You cannot have plasticity in isolation. It's an absolute impossibility." His experiments have shown that if one brain system changes, those systems connected to it change as well. The same plastic rules, use it or lose it, or neurons that fire together wire together, apply throughout. Different areas of the brain wouldn't be able to function together if that weren't the case. Do the same plastic rules that apply to brain maps in the sensory, motor, and language cortices apply to more complex maps, such as those that represent our relationships, sexual or otherwise? Mrzenik has also shown that complex brain maps are governed by the same plastic principles as simpler maps. Animals exposed to a simple tone will develop a single brain map region to process it. Animals exposed to a complex pattern, such as a melody of six tones, will not simply link together six different map regions, but will develop a region that encodes the entire melody. These more complex melody maps obey the same plastic principles as maps for single tones. The sexual instincts, wrote Freud, are noticeable to us for their plasticity, their capacity for altering their aims. Freud was not the first to argue that sexuality was plastic. Plato, in his dialogue on love, argued that human eros took many forms, but Freud laid the foundations for a neuroscientific understanding of sexual and romantic plasticity. One of his most important contributions was his discovery of critical periods for sexual plasticity. Freud argued that an adult's ability to love intimately and sexually unfolds in stages, beginning in the infant's first passionate attachments to its parents. He learned from his patients and from observing children that early childhood, not puberty, was the first critical period for sexuality and intimacy, and that children are capable of passionate, proto-sexual feelings, crushes, loving feelings, and in some cases even sexual excitement, as A was. Freud discovered that the sexual abuse of children is harmful because it influences the critical period of sexuality in childhood, shaping our later attractions and thoughts about sex. Children are needy and typically develop passionate attachments to their parents. If the parent is warm, gentle, and reliable, the child will frequently develop a taste for that kind of relationship later on. If the parent is disengaged, cool, distant, self-involved, angry, ambivalent, or erratic, the child may seek out an adult mate who has similar tendencies. There are exceptions, but a significant body of research now confirms Freud's basic insight that early patterns of relating and attaching to others, if problematic, can get wired into our brains in childhood and repeated in adulthood. Many aspects of the sexual script that A played out when he first came to see me were repetitions of his traumatic childhood situation, thinly disguised, such as his being attracted to an unstable woman who crossed normal sexual boundaries in furtive relationships, where hostility and sexual excitement were merged, while the woman's official partner was cuckolded and threatening to re-enter the scene. The idea of the critical period was formulated around the time Freud started writing about sex and love by embryologists who observed that in the embryo the nervous system develops in stages and that if these stages are disturbed, the animal or person will be harmed, often catastrophically, for life. Though Freud didn't use the term, what he said about the early stages of sexual development conforms to what we know about critical periods. They are brief windows of time when new brain systems and maps develop with the help of stimulation from the people in one's environment. Traces of childhood sentiments in adult love and sexuality are detectable in everyday behaviors. When adults in our culture have tender foreplay or express their most intimate adoration, they often call each other baby or babe. They use terms of endearment that their mothers used with them as children, such as honey and sweetie pie. Terms that evoke the earliest months of life when the mother expressed her love by feeding, caressing, and talking sweetly to her baby. What Freud called the oral phase, the first critical period of sexuality, the essence of which is summed up in the words nurturance and nourish, tenderly caring for, loving, and feeding. The baby feels merged with the mother, and its trust of others develops as the baby is held and nurtured with a sugary food, milk. Being loved, cared for, and fed are mentally associated in the mind and wired together in the brain in our first formative experience after birth. When adults talk baby talk, using words such as sweetie pie and baby to address each other, and give their conversation an oral flavor, they are, according to Freud, regressing, moving from mature mental states of relating to earlier phases of life. In terms of plasticity, such regression, I believe, involves unmasking old neuronal pathways that then trigger all the associations of that earlier phase. Regression can be pleasant and harmless, as in adult foreplay, or it can be problematic, as when infantile aggressive pathways are unmasked and an adult has a temper tantrum. Even talking dirty shows traces of infantile sexual stages. After all, why should sex be thought dirty at all? This attitude reflects a child's view of sex from a stage when it is conscious of toilet training, urination, and defecation, and is surprised to learn that the genitals, which are involved in urination, and so close to the anus, are also involved in sex, and that mommy permits daddy to insert his dirty organ in a hole that is very close to her bottom. Adults are not generally bothered by this, because in adolescence they have gone through another critical period of sexual plasticity, in which their brains reorganized again, so that the pleasure of sex becomes intense enough to override any disgust. Freud showed that many sexual mysteries can be understood as critical period fixations. After Freud, we are no longer surprised that the girl whose father left her as a child pursues unavailable men old enough to be her father, or that people raised by ice queen mothers often seek such people out as partners, sometimes becoming icy themselves, because never having experienced empathy in the critical period, a whole part of their brains failed to develop. And many perversions can be explained in terms of plasticity and the persistence of childhood conflicts. But the main point is that in our critical periods we can acquire sexual and romantic tastes and inclinations that get wired into our brains and can have a powerful impact for the rest of our lives.
This is the end of disc number 3. Please insert disc number 4.